These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The Middle East has been a foreign policy trouble spot for American presidents for decades, from Jimmy Carter's Camp David Accords, establishing peace between Israel and Egypt, all the way up to President Obama's controversial nuclear deal with Iran. Now, a new administration inherits some longstanding challenges from this region: terrorism threats, the Syrian civil war, growing Russian involvement, and more. And while it's far too early to say how the Trump foreign policy team will address these, today in The Exchange, we lay out what they face in this troubled part of the world. And let's hear from you. Your questions, comments, concerns are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guests are both panelists at the New Hampshire World Affairs Council's event tonight at SNHU on this topic. They are Jessica Tuckman Matthews. She's a distinguished fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, served as its president for almost two decades. Before that, she worked at the National Security Council and at the State Department. And Jessica Tuckman Matthews, what a pleasure. Thank you so much, and welcome to New Hampshire.
It's terrific to be here, Lauren.
Also with us, Jim Smith. He was the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia for 4.5 years. He stepped down in 2013. Before that, he was an executive with the Raytheon Company. Today, he's dean of the College of Engineering at SNHU. He's also a retired brigadier general in the Air Force. And again, Jim Smith, a big pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, I want to start with you, Jessica. Sometimes when we've talked about this region before on The Exchange, people call in and they say, why is the Middle East such a mess to begin with? How would you answer that?
History. This is a region that was under colonial rule until not that long ago. It has not really developed governance that engages citizens, that and so it's had autocratic rulers through most of it. And, you know, the answer to the question of why Arab culture has gone through such a dip in recent centuries is one that's really kind of beyond this conversation. But let's say it suffered from colonialism. Most of it has suffered from the so-called oil curse of what happens with governments that have this easy stream of lots and lots of income and don't have to worry about serving their citizens. And it has had a tradition of very bad governance. And those three things put together have produced a pretty toxic environment.
What do you think, Jim?
Well, I would agree with her. The traditional social contract in the region was between a government and its subjects. But with the advent of the iPhone and the BlackBerry and social media, the people of the region no longer see themselves as subjects. They see themselves as citizens with a voice and a mechanism to express their voice. And Saudi Arabia, for example, has the highest penetration of Twitter usage of any country in the world.
Wow, I didn't know that.
So that social contract is changing, not because the governments have driven the change, but because people have driven the change through modern technology. Now it's a question of how do those governments respond? And if you look at the traditional response of cracking down on your subjects, that has failed at every step. Those governments who have been responsive to their people, and I agree with Jessica, for those that are oil rich, they've used resources to respond. But nonetheless, you're seeing those governments that respond in a positive way have remained stable. Now the question is, will they continue that modernization?
Even before the advent of social media, and it's real interesting what you say about Twitter, Jim, though a lot of Americans would look at the Middle East and say, ugh, it's a mess. Why are we even there? I mean, why do you think this region has been so troubled for the past, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 years?
Well, as Jessica rightly said, it's a region that faced a colonial experience. It takes some generations to overcome that. But I remember watching in Tahrir Square, and I was stunned by the fact that there were no American flags being burned. There were no British flags being burned. Lots of British flags had been burned in Cairo over the decades, and no Israeli flags. And I realized that this was not about us anymore. It was about them. And I thought for a while, and I realized it was the first time in 700 years the debate was not about someone else. In the 13th century, Baghdad was the Dar al-Hikmah. It was the house of wisdom. And then the Mongols came in and leveled it. They were there for about 300 years. And then we've got the Ottoman Empire that was there for about 300 years. And then you got the colonial experience. So we only see the emergence of local governance, regional governance models, really in the last generation. So they default to authoritarian models.
Because that's what's gone on for so long.
That's what's gone. So they patterned that. But now we're going through an era where you can't say one thing and do another. You can't say one thing to your people and do another, because with an iPhone, you can take a picture of people's actions. So it's a different dynamic. And now the issue is, how will governments respond to that?
You actually sound kind of hopeful. What do you think, Jessica?
Well, I think before we move on, we have to add in the question of why the Middle East is the way it is today, the U.S. invasion of Iraq, which was, I think, a monumental tragedy and mistake. When you talk to Iraqis before the war and you say, who are you? You know, somebody would say, well, I'm an Iraqi. I'm a professor of chemistry, et cetera. They did not answer, I'm a Shia or a Sunni. Right? So one of the results of the war was to bring up the Shia-Sunni conflict, not just in Iraq, but across the region, in a way that it had not dominated before and which we can't. So, and the other, of course, was the Arab Awakening, and Jim started to you know, talking about Tahrir Square, and I agree that, you know, the wonderful news about it was that it wasn't about the U.S.
That
and
was
it wasn't
again,
about
the Egyptian,
any outsider.
The protests
was,
in Egypt that we heard about a couple years ago.
What is normally called the Arab Spring should never have been called that, because that suggested that it was going to be a few months before everything was happy again. And people who really knew the region and knew movements like this knew it was more likely to be generations. So we've always at Carnegie called it the Arab Awakening, as have others, to kind of underline that. But it is important to say that the part of the problem is that in the years of authoritarian rule, the only allowed channel for either opposition or self-governance was religious, were religious groups. Because they were outside of the things that were allowed or
political
forbidden.
Control.
So that made them after the series of revolutions across the region, that made the religious groups the prominent channel for political activity, which when you're trying to get a secular government and when you're trying to get around the Shia Sunni split, is a huge problem. So that also is part of what we're seeing there.
So that's super interesting. So these dictatorial regimes, autocratic regimes, the only outside expression was through religious organizations.
The Muslim Brotherhood, et cetera, and in Egypt, for example, was a way for people both to be engaged in a civic level, but also to express opposition to government policies.
So civic organizations, labor unions, political parties, those aren't really...
Those became banned. I mean, those didn't or didn't exist.
Really interesting. And I did want to ask you, too, Jim, about the Arab Spring, Arab Awakening that Jessica mentions. But let me also invite our listeners to join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. And today in the exchange, we're looking at the challenges the new Trump foreign policy team will face in the Middle East with two guests, both of whom have been looking at these issues for a long time. Both panelists at the New Hampshire World Affairs Council's event tonight on this topic. For more information on that event, go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. You can give us a call now at 1-800-892-6477 or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Jim Smith, I'd love your thoughts too on what Jessica says. You know, a lot of people say, whatever happened to the Arab Spring? I thought things were moving along there.
Well, liberals start revolutions. They rarely capitalize on them. That's true through history. That was true in Cairo. But the Arab Spring, Arab Awakening, I agree with that terminology, is going to go on for another 20 years. And we don't know what the result is going to be.
Which direction it will go in.
Yes. If you look in Egypt now, there seems to be exhaustion on the part of those that participated. So we have a new government that looks very much like the government of Mubarak. So it appears that it's stalemated in Cairo. The Green Revolution was put down violently in Tehran. That does not seem to be moving forward. If you look in the Gulf, on the other hand, you have governments, and again, they are resource rich up until 18 months ago. But you see a series of evolutionary moves to allow participatory government. I didn't say democracy, participatory government, and also governments that are responsive to the concerns of their populations. So in Saudi Arabia, probably more so in Qatar and the Emirates and Oman in particular, you're actually seeing a positive evolution in governance. But we haven't faced crises there yet. So if the reduction in resources creates an environment where the government cannot respond the way they used to, what will be their response? And if we default to the traditional crackdown, then that will be a reversal.
So it was easy to keep people happy, Jim, when oil resources were rich and, you know, people had plenty to eat and, you know, reasonable places to live.
Yeah, but in places like Oman, where they have not had a lot of resources, you actually had a very forward-thinking leader in Sultan Qaboos who was engaged with the population, and they were perceived as being part of the government and part of the future. That really is going to be the key.
Well, and Jessica, let's follow up because I can tell you wanted to. On Jim's point, areas that were resource rich, he said, up until 18 months ago.
Well, of course, that's when oil prices crashed and lost 50% of their value in less than a year. What I think most people don't realize is how drastically American import dependence has changed. In the 1970s, we were importing close to 70% of our oil, and most of it from the Middle East. Today, 2015, which is our most recent data, we imported 24%, which is the lowest level since 1970. And so that's 45 years. You know, we are down to the lowest level. And 40% of those imports are from Canada.
Wow.
So
we don't need
completely
Middle East
different,
oil
it's
anymore.
A completely different picture. You know, that, and we are trying also because of climate change, we have to bring oil use down further. So the world, oil prices are low. They will go up and down and, you know, over the short term, but the long term trend is almost certainly down. There's more oil in the world capacity than is being pumped right now.
And fracking has made the U.S. much more energy independent than it used to be.
That's where a big part of that low 24% comes from. We're now a major producer, which we haven't been for a long, long time. And so the obsession with reliability of oil imports from the Middle East is no longer for us. Now, that's not to say that it doesn't matter for the rest of the world that is more dependent, for China, for example. But there's lots of oil around, and there's more that could be pumped in Saudi Arabia, which has cut back. In Iran, if the deal, the Iran deal holds and their industry comes back, there's lots of oil around. So oil shortages and the security of oil supply is not for us what it once was.
Well, and I'm old enough to remember those lines at the gas stations and, you know, the days when you couldn't get gas and so forth. Right. But here's the meta question then out of what you just said, Jessica. For a long time, you know, people said when they were feeling cynical about the Middle East, you know, we're only there for the oil.
Right.
So now if we're not there for the oil, you know, why are we still there? Maybe we should just get out.
Well, first of all, the world isn't divisible neatly anyway. I mean, if we are engaged in the world, we're engaged to some degree in all of it. That's one thing that's important to say. Secondly, we have major interests in the Middle East other than oil. And certainly now, other than oil, Israel is an important interest of ours. But the region as a whole, obviously population movements, as we've seen, from Syria and elsewhere, the impact on the rest of the world of major population movements is enormous. That's an interest of ours. We have an indivisible interest in international leadership that we can't say, well, we're going to ignore this hunk of the world and only look at that. But it is the case that Iraq, that Afghanistan, the war in Afghanistan and in Iraq, much especially in Iraq, brought us a depth of engagement and commitments that look, in retrospect, like a serious mistake. And those, we can debate the degree to which we can simply walk away from them. One thing we know is that the big, probably among the two or three biggest threats in the world right now are from ungoverned spaces where the national government cannot control its. So Iraq could be an ungoverned space if we just walk away from ISIS, Syria, et cetera. So that's an interest we can't walk away from because of terrorism.
And we've seen terrorist attacks in Paris and in Berlin and here in the U.S.
So there are a set of interests we can't. But I will say just quickly at the end that I think looking back at the 8 years of the Obama administration, that one of its tragedies is too strong a word, but one of the certainly the big regrets was that the so-called originally the pivot, badly named, but the rebalance of American attention towards Asia, that the president wanted to make and it never really happened beyond the rhetorical level because we kept getting dragged back into the consequences of things that we had already done. And, you know, that, of course, was the cost, the big cost of the Iraq war, what it set loose across the region.
Real quickly, Jim, and maybe we'll pick up more after a break. Again, if it's not about the oil anymore, should we? OK. And I asked rhetorically, should we pull out? Jessica explained why she thinks we should not. But could we pull back?
You could certainly pull back. But I'm going to take Jessica's argument in a little different direction. There are many other reasons to be there other than oil. But don't discount the importance of oil, not for us, but for our allies in Asia and Europe.
Okay.
And if there's a disruption of oil, that has a huge impact in the global economy that we will feel here. So it's not as simple as saying we don't need your oil, therefore
it doesn't matter.
Yeah. We'll pull out more on that after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. If you subscribe to email newsletters for stories you should be reading, add yourself to our list at nhpr.org. You get a twice-weekly rundown of the stories that matter from the State House to the North Country and beyond. You can subscribe to our newsletter right now at nhpr.org. Mostly cloudy for today with a chance of some rain showers, high temperatures in the 40s. It'll be partly to mostly cloudy tonight. North Country has a chance of rain and snow showers, lows tonight in the 20s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Bank of New Hampshire Pavilion, presenting Tedeschi Trucks Band, featuring the Wood Brothers in Hot Tuna on July 1st. Tickets available Friday at 10 a.m., banknhpavilion.com. M Vintage Kitchens of Concord, designing 21st century kitchens that complement your home's architectural style. Information and portfolio online at vintagekitchens.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Middle East challenges the new Trump foreign policy team will face in this region. Our guests are both panelists at a New Hampshire World Affairs Council event on this topic tonight at SNHU. To learn more, go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. You can give us a call now, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So, Jim Smith, go ahead. I want to let you finish up that point that even though America doesn't need Middle East oil nearly as much as it used to, as Jessica explained, we still have an interest in the stability of the oil supply coming from that region.
Well, you have a stability, importance in the stability of the global economy, and oil is a key piece of that. But there are other considerations in terms of stability. The United States Navy is the only Navy in the world that can guarantee freedom of navigation in international waters. So if we allow the Straits of Hormuz to be closed, you've established a precedent that other countries can do the same. So the Straits of Malacca and other places of the world now are at risk. We have very important allies in the region. And first on that list is Israel. If you withdraw, you've left them to by themselves. And I don't think we want to do that. If you're not in the region, you can't influence the region. So there's every reason to stay. But it's a legitimate question to ask, what are the instruments of national power that you're focused on? I would argue that our foreign policy in the region has become way militarized, too much so. And we haven't leveraged our political diplomatic influence or our economic. And I would really focus on the economic. If you look in Asia, we've got the APEC, Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. Think of that as a model for the region where you take 20 to 25 countries in the region with a commitment to making the region competitive in a global economy. That in itself would be an aspiration where we would bring our political, our diplomatic, and economic power to bear on the region, but not focused on the military. So I don't think it's an issue of withdrawing as much as it is a refocus of how we're using our influence.
Well, go ahead, Jessica.
No, I totally agree with that.
So speaking of, you know, American influence and how it should be expressed in the region, I did want to ask both of you, and Jessica, you first, about expanding Russian influence in the Middle East. How do you interpret what especially Vladimir Putin is trying to do? What do you think his goals are?
I think he wanted to get back into the Middle East when he went into Syria to begin with. He saw an opportunity to do it, and he has exploited it brilliantly. It gave me kind of the shivers a few days ago at the meeting in Astana, the capital of Kazakhstan, which was Russia, Iran, Turkey as the major powers shaping the ceasefire, we hope, in Syria. So Russia has come back into the region. It wants to craft a political outcome in Syria, a military and political outcome that will consolidate its reentry there. It would probably like to expand its influence and footprint in the region. you have to give Putin credit for really, you know, it's been a despicable military campaign of attacks on civilians, and not on ISIS, but on the regime's opponents. But he rescued Assad, President Assad of Syria, who was just about to fall when he went back in. And he has also now solidified a Russian presence in Syria.
Why is Russia so interested in propping up Syria, especially President Assad?
They were they've been long-time allies, long time. And because and this gives Russia not simply a tie and a role, but a physical base in the region from which it can expand.
What do you think, Jim? And how do you view this increasing, you know, Russian participation in the Middle East?
Most people look at the last 30 years, 50 years, and say there was a Cold War, Berlin Wall came down, U.S. was the only superpower left, and now we're dealing with it. Yes, we had one Cold War that lasted 40 years. I'm going to submit to you that we're in the second Cold War right now.
I was going to say it feels like the Cold War all over again.
Well, but the first Cold War was a conflict between economic models, the communist versus the free market. And the centerpiece of that was military power. The second Cold War is really the byproduct of the breakdown of the Westphalian Peace, which defined relations between nation states, goes back to 1648. We lived under that for 350 years. And it said that warfare was between nation states, but the caveat was that which went on inside the borders was not subject to interference by an outside power. And if you look after the Berlin Wall came down, we then engaged in humanitarian intervention. And really as a reaction to the massacres in Africa. So arguably Bosnia was a breakdown in Westphalian, the interpretation of Westphalian peace. Kosovo, the same thing. And arguably the decision for Libya early on was that. And then in Syria, the first thing that was said is regime change. So you have the West now moving toward humanitarian intervention. That interpretation of the Westphalian peace is not embraced by China, Russia, and Iran. So what I see is a second Cold War of competing political models between democratic traditions and human rights and authoritarian models. And I see essentially a cabal between China, Russia, Iran, authoritarian states to undermine U.S. power and influence in the world. They can't do it militarily, but they're taking advantage of other opportunities to undermine our influence.
Opportunities like the Syrian civil war.
We are in the middle of a political Cold War, and we've got to come to terms with that.
You know, I noticed you didn't put Turkey in that list of actors, you know, Russia, Iran, China.
Turkey is a very complicated issue. And I think
teenagers would call it a frenemy.
Well, it is.
Not really a friend, not really an enemy. We're not really sure.
Well, but that's true with a lot of our relationships in the world. Turkey has been a very strong ally in NATO over the years. I've got a lot of experience of flying with their Air Force. Istanbul is one of the wonderful cities of the world to visit. I call it the attic of history because everything is there and you have to peel it back. But again, with Erdogan, you have a move toward an Islamic government, an undermining of the tradition of the military and liberal traditions. And we don't know where they're going with that. They see themselves as a crossroad between Europe and Asia. In the last few generations, the focus has been more on the West and Europe. Here in the last decade, more toward the other direction, toward the East. And we don't know how that's going to turn out.
And
go ahead.
We finally reached an area of some disagreement. I don't think that there is a cabal between Russia, China, Iran against the U.S. That suggests not suggests, but it means that they have a common purpose. And I don't think that's at all the case. It's true that Westphalian borders are disappearing. They're disappearing because of globalization, right? For several decades now, money, information, natural resources, climate, illegal materials, drugs, all these things have moved across borders that are increasingly porous. That's because of technology and trade and the ways in which the world economy has gone together. That's a hugely important thing, and it changes our notions of national sovereignty. But I don't think that you turn that into a political argument that, you know, that these countries, because they have different sets of interests than we, are engaged together in something nefarious against us. They may individually be, and we certainly have differences. We also have some areas of similarity. So I think that's, this is not, it's not new. It's, you know, it's continuing and deepening. It's what it is what globalization really means in practice. That's what's happened, is borders have become very porous to almost everything except the movement of people. And that's, you know, in terms of international governance, that's what we're dealing with.
The phone number again for you to join us here in The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Today in The Exchange, we are just laying out what the new president's foreign policy team will face in a very difficult part of the world, the Middle East. Our two guests both have long experience in this area. They're both panelists, by the way, at the New Hampshire World Affairs Council's event tonight on this topic. If you want more information on that event, go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. You can join us now with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So both of you have laid out this very broad, complicated, and deeply historical picture of the Middle East and why it's so difficult. I'd love to ask you about some very specific concerns that Americans have right now. And I'll turn to you first, Jessica. I think if you asked a lot of people what's the number one problem in the Middle East, they would say ISIS. So many questions that I could ask both of you about. But just first of all, Jessica, if you can remind us where ISIS came from. I mean, 10 years ago, nobody was talking about ISIS.
It came out of Al-Qaeda as a more radical group and split with Al-Qaeda because it was even more radical in its aims and in its ambition to actually rule territory. Militarily, people expect the battle for Mosul, to retake Mosul, the most important city in northern Iraq, from ISIS, will reach a very important milestone with the sort of taking back the eastern half of the city within a matter of days. And then there will be a major battle for the western half of the city. It's a lot of people. It's almost 800,000 people. You know, it's the size of Seattle.
Yeah.
That are still in the West. But there has been a steady success, slow and difficult and with a lot of humanitarian suffering, but retaking the space in Iraq that ISIS had taken. And more and more, it's the Iraqi army that is doing the fighting with American support and advice and logistical help. But it is... I think you'd have to say it's going well. I don't know Jim's sense of that. It's still going to be long, and you still have this enormous problem, which is an open border between Iraq and Syria. So, the strategy is to push ISIS out of this Iraqi space and back towards Syria, where then we, in a more compressed area, we'll have to face it militarily. We are fighting ISIS much better online than we have. We caught up and are doing well in terms of stopping their recruitment and stopping their revolting posts and videos and stuff. So that arm of the battle has been catch up, and I think it's going pretty well. This is going to be a long, slow struggle, but a huge part of their attraction to people outside the region was success. And once they stop having success, they will stop being able to recruit in the same way.
I definitely want to follow up on that recruitment question in a minute, Jessica, because we talked to somebody from the State Department a couple years ago who was working on that very effort. But Jim, we just finished, you know, a long campaign. I interviewed, you know, lots of candidates for president, U.S. Senate, Congress, and to a person, no matter what the party, they all said, we have to defeat ISIS. It's such a big statement. I mean, how do you even go about beginning to do that task?
Well, when people say defeat Daesh, ISIS, they're thinking about a military victory. But anytime you do military campaign planning, and I've done much of that in my career, the first question you've got to ask is, then what? So we will retake Mosul. We will roll back Daesh in Iraq and then in Syria.
Daesh, again, is the sort of derogatory name for ISIS.
That's what the Arabs call it.
The local name.
Yeah.
But then the long-term challenge presents itself, which is the campaign to undermine support for extremism.
Right.
How do you do that? And that has to start with a regional dialogue, which we can help influence, but we can't lead it. So the countries of the region have got to come to terms with the real values in Islam and an accountability for that. And this is going to be a part of a national and regional dialogue. And you can see within Saudi Arabia, with their reconciliation effort, processes that start to get at that. But the long-term effort is not a military victory on the field of battle. It is an intellectual battle of ideas to undermine the support for extremism.
What is that reconciliation process that you mentioned in Saudi Arabia?
Well, this has been in works for about a decade. So Al-Qaeda was the major threat there, and they were... went through a process of how do I deal with captives or people that turn themselves in. And the natural response was you throw them in jail and you deal with it in a traditional way.
So this is the Saudi government.
Yes,
how do
Saudi
I deal
government.
With Al-Qaeda
yes, right.
Adherence within our
right.
own society? And we should say that most of, if not all of the 9/11 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. Is that right, Jim?
15 of the 19. But let's be clear on what they were doing, because that is misunderstood. My question back to you is, how many of the pilots were Saudi? Because the pilots were one that were part of the that understood the plan, and none of them were. They're Egyptian, Lebanese, and Emiratis. The Saudis were the thugs, okay, that had been recruited. So to suggest that 15 of the 19 were Saudis, therefore the Saudi government was behind the attacks on the World Trade Center, is totally misleading.
No, and I'm not suggesting the Saudi government was. I'm trying to relate to what you said about there were Al-Qaeda elements within Saudi society, and the Saudi government has been on this process to try to, I think you said, reconcile with these.
Yes, and in fact, an important point, the recruits for the 9/11 were in parts of the country that were not core Al-Qaeda strongholds. And Osama bin Laden was trying to expand his recruiting base. So this is why these people were chosen. Now, what the Saudi government did, and this is Mohammed bin Naif, who's he's the crown prince now and minister of interior, evolved to a strategy of dealing with them with an understanding of the culture. So you bring them in, you arrest them, you integrate the family, an imam from their tribe, you go through a reconciliation process, which involves going through the Quran page by page by page.
Wow.
Because they've never read it. They've only taken what somebody's told them. And then at the end of this...
Jim, I have to jump in. I do apologize. We will finish that up in just a minute. Stay with us. This is The Exchange.
This is NHPR. It's 939.
I'm Joshua Johnson. On the next 1A, fixing immigration. All sides agree the system is broken. These days, undocumented immigrants are increasingly coming from Central America, not Mexico. And by some counts, more than 11 million people are already in the U.S. without papers. President Trump is moving ahead with a border wall. Is that the best solution? Who gets to come to America and who gets to stay?
That's 1A coming up at 10 o'clock on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from the law firm of Oren Reno, bringing sound judgment and a practical approach to New England's legal challenges for more than 65 years, online at or-reno.com. And University of New Hampshire at Manchester, preparing students for medical careers with degrees in biological sciences, biotechnology, and neuropsychology. manchester.unh.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, what awaits a new administration in a tough foreign policy terrain? The Middle East. Both of our guests are panelists at the New Hampshire World Affairs Council event tonight on this topic at SNHU. If you want to learn more about that event, go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. The number for you to call in right now is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Jessica Tuckman-Matthews, Jim Smith, a couple emails that I want to share with you. But Jim, I do want to let you finish up your point. You were describing a situation in Saudi Arabia that I don't think a lot of people realize, that the government is trying to work with, reach out to former members of Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, again, their counter Al-Qaeda strategy was one of engaging in the context of their society. And they've been very successful in that. Our strategy has been largely kinetic and tactical, the drone strategy. Theirs is to bring someone back into the family. And if you compare the numbers of Saudis who have gone to Syria, for example, it's down drastically from what we saw going into Iraq in 2004 or into Afghanistan during that conflict against the Russians. It is a model of dialogue, though, and when I look at the need for dialogue to counter support for extremism, that's kind of where I would start as the model. So you've got a national model, let's expand it to a regional model and bring everyone in. And then if you focus on economic development as a part of that, then you have a path to success. Which leads to the next issue, the new leadership in Saudi Arabia. The deputy crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, King Salman's son, has focused on a Saudi vision 2030 to move to a private sector economy. Very, very important to move away from this state-run economy. If they're successful at that, then you're going to have jobs for this generation of highly educated Saudis, and they will have a future.
Well, you're making me feel actually a little bit hopeful, at least about some aspects of this troubled region.
There is an opportunity for success.
You know, Jessica, I did want to just ask you very quickly a little bit more about this recruitment message. You seemed to say a moment ago that the U.S. is finally catching up to ISIS's recruitment message.
U.S. and the West.
U.S. and the West in general. We sat down with a top State Department official a couple years ago who this is his sole focus, what he does. I wonder, though, you know, how possible is it that the U.S. could really create a compelling enough counter-narrative to ISIS that would sway somebody who was maybe on the verge of joining this group? You know, is that wishful thinking or is that actually possible?
It's possible in some cases, and I'm sure in some not, because a great many of the people who are attracted are people who are sort of in an emotional hole. And they need something all-encompassing to hang on to or something very, very dark. But as Jim has described, it's often a person-by-person. So part of the task is identifying people who are getting caught up in this and then focusing attention on those particular individuals and either trying to reshape their thinking or tracking their movements. But this is, as he said before, and as I, as both of us have said, this is going to be a generational struggle that will burn itself out in the same way that ideological terrorism in Europe in the 1970s burned itself out. It will be long and slow, but we will, I think, military success in terms of the ISIS's attempt to rule territory, to be a caliphate, is an important part of it, and that's going well.
Well, a couple emails have come in, and Mike takes issue with your characterization, I think it was, Jessica, that the Iraq war was a mistake. Mike says Saddam Hussein and his family were murderous villains, and the invasion, for all its flaws, gave Iraqis hope for representative democracy, partisan as it is, and self-governance. Mike says President Obama's non-commitment to the region through his lack of real military engagement has strongly contributed to the lack of stability in the region and the issues in Iraq and Syria. Mike, thank you for the email. And just real quick, Jessica, what do you think? That, and I've heard other people say this too. Saddam was a really bad guy. He gassed his own people. The region's better off without him.
He was a really bad guy. There's lots of really bad guys in the world. But if you look on balance at the causes and costs and consequences of that war, to me, it is the negatives outweigh the positives, not by a little, but by a tremendous amount, and including for Iraqis. An awful lot of Iraqis died as a result of and an awful lot of irreparable damage to the country, both to its social fabric and to its physical condition. Let's remember the ostensible reason for invading Iraq was false, that there were active weapons of mass destruction programs there. And we have learned, I think, that there are problems that you cannot solve with the military because of what Ambassador Smith has rightly pointed to. It's the then what question. What happens afterwards when you decapitate a country? Then you leave a political vacuum, and then people are going to fight for power within that vacuum. That's what we've been seeing for the last 13 years in Iraq.
Well, Mike, thank you for the email. Here's another one from Jerry in Dover. Jerry says, when Russia, Putin, realized that causing the refugee exodus in Syria was destabilizing NATO, they intensified and expanded their target list, which further magnified the problem. Russia then tried and in some respects succeeded in casting doubts on the electoral process in many democracies, including the U.S. Jerry, thank you so much for the email. I think we'll stick to the Middle East aspect of this. And Jim, maybe to you, Russia is causing trouble in Syria, partly because it destabilizes NATO.
Well, it gets back to my argument. Everything that they're doing is an attempt to undermine the Western alliances, make us second-guess democratic institutions. So I see the acceleration of intensity in Syria and the exodus of people and the impact that is having on our NATO allies as part and parcel of a larger strategy of destabilizing Western institutions. So I quite agree with Jerry.
Jerry, thank you for the email. And again, you can email us at exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So both of you, we've talked a lot about Russia, the Syrian civil war, ISIS, some of the bigger, broader issues in this region. We haven't talked specifically yet, though, Jessica, about the Iran nuclear deal. And boy, I heard a lot about this during the campaign from candidates, again, from all kinds of offices, with Democrats largely supporting this deal, Republicans largely opposing it. But it's not just a U.S.-Iran bilateral deal. I mean, the way it's framed, it sounds like it. Who's involved in this, Jessica?
Well, it's the so-called P5 plus one, which is Russia, China, the United States, Britain, France, and Germany on one side.
So lots of countries.
And Iran, a lot of countries. And the EU as a player as well. So that increases the number of countries. So it is not a bilateral deal. It's a multilateral deal. You know, this is an area, notwithstanding what people heard in the campaign, this is an area of good news. Because Donald Trump is the first American president in several decades who has taken office without having to worry about the threat of growing nuclear power in Iran. And that's a big, big deal. It's almost exactly a year since the agreement entered into full force, January 16th. So what is it, a year and 10 days. And so far, Iran has done everything required of it. It has exported all of its highly enriched uranium. It has exported all of its low-enriched uranium except 300 kilograms, which is a militarily an infinitesimal amount. It has destroyed its plutonium production reactor. It has opened the country to continuous IAEA inspection, both physical and by camera and by other means. Everything that was set out in this 160-page, highly technical, highly detailed agreement has been done. And mostly everything that we were required to do has been done as well. But there's a whole set of things that we are required to do in terms of lifting so-called secondary sanctions and not reimposing new ones.
So there's a next step.
So it's a
on
there
our side.
Are active. The president has to certify to Congress at regular intervals, 90 days, 120 days, that the agreement is in force and being closely monitored and effective. So, what is I would view as really a tragedy, if we took an agreement that was the first time this country in many decades has taken a major national security threat and addressed it through economic and political means rather than military means.
Which is what Jim has been talking about.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it is the first time we through decades of work, built broad multilateral support for sanctions that became highly effective. They really destroyed the Iranian economy. Inflation, they took 2/3 of Iran's nuclear exports. They destroyed the value of the currency. I mean, they were enormously effective because they were so widely supported internationally. And we used that pressure to negotiate an agreement, and we were lucky to have a new political leadership in Iran, President Rouhani, who was elected in the spring of 2014, who ran on the platform of so-called flexibility and moderation with respect to Iran's nuclear program. It couldn't have been done with Ahmadinejad. So we now have a deal that Israel's own national security leaders say is a strategic turning point.
Because initially they were quite upset about
Bibi Netanyahu still hates it, but he hated it before the deal even existed. So you know that this wasn't about its terms because the terms weren't agreed to yet. But the generals and the head of Israeli intelligence that have looked at it, the deal since it was reached, are very, very clear. And I have an op-ed piece in today's Union Leader that quotes the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Israel on his public view, where he's completely on the other side of the picture from Netanyahu.
Well, and we've got a link on our website to that.
So,
you know,
my argument is, and I hope the new administration will take a serious look now that they, outside of the campaign pressures, at what this 160 pages actually says, at what's happened since in the last year and a half, and what the alternatives are. Because the alternatives before a deal was negotiated, there were only three. One was to keep on trying to put on additional force, sanctions, And these Iranians were meeting that with additional centrifuges. The second one was an attack. And the third was a negotiated deal that does necessarily involve some compromise.
There were a lot of criticisms of the deal levied in the campaign. I don't have time to go through all of them now, Jessica, but I did want to ask you, Jim, do some of the neighboring states in this region have concerns about the Iran deal?
Well, they do. And I agree with Jessica on her assessment of the deal from Washington, because the last administration saw the Iran nuclear deal as an end in itself. The countries in the region don't see it that way at all. They agreed that Iran's nuclear ambitions should be stemmed. Their biggest concern is Iran's meddling in the internal affairs of the countries of the region. I would argue that having that deal in place gives us an opportunity for engagement.
To say to Iran,
So we've got to focus on that. And we've got 14 years now to change the dynamic that obviates the need for Iran to have nuclear weapons. So we have an important job to do over the next 14 years. And it has nothing to do with arguing about the deal. It's about changing the future.
But, you know, it's also important to say that many of the Gulf states, there's a real paradox here. They are frightened because the deal opens up for them the vision of an Iranian-American rapprochement. I mean, for a long, long time, the U.S. and Iran were very close allies, and they haven't forgotten that. And they see this non-Arab country, it's enormously powerful, the regional hegemon, and the U.S. as perhaps now having removed the big bar from the relationship. And Iran was a pariah for 35 years, and people got used to it. Every country in the region especially got used to that. But it was never going to stay in the penalty box forever. And so in some ways, the deal also makes things politically, as Jim says, it makes some things harder for them because now Iran is not frozen out.
That's interesting. So some of those countries don't want the U.S. and Iran to be friends, if I can
absolutely
put it very simply.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Saudi Arabia is the leading Sunni country in the region. Iran is the leading Shia country. Iran is a Persian, not an Arab culture. There are major issues, and Iran is also doing lots of things in their countries that are offensive and dangerous and worrisome.
Mike, excuse me, Jim, I wanted to give you a very quick chance to respond to Mike's email saying that the Iraq War was not a mistake. And again, Mike, thank you for that email.
He said something very important, and that was we gave them a chance for democracy. Having flown in combat myself, I would say that every soldier, sailor, airman, and Marine that was involved in conflicts there saw that as their mission. They should be proud of that contribution that they made. The fact that our government did not understand the unintended consequences in no way lessens their contribution.
That's the point that you made, Jessica. Yeah, and that some people have said, if you break it, you have to know what to do afterwards, how to put it back together. Yeah. This has been so interesting. And if folks want to hear more from you, they can go to Southern New Hampshire University tonight. For more information on that event, you can go to our website at nhpr.org/exchange. Jessica Tuckman Matthews, Jim Smith, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thanks.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search iTunes or Google Play for NHPR Exchange.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. A break in the cold case of a New Hampshire woman missing for 30 years. The legislature tackles public education, water contamination, and drought relief for dairy farmers. And as voter fraud returns to the national headlines, New Hampshire lawmakers rewrite state voting laws. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange.
tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 7 p.m. on NHPR.
Next at 10 o'clock on NHPR, mostly cloudy for today with a chance of some rain showers, high temperatures in the 40s. Then partly to mostly cloudy tonight, and North Country has a chance of rain and snow showers, lows tonight in the 20s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Goodwill of Northern New England, putting your stuff and people to work. 10 locations in New Hampshire. Learn more at goodwillnne.org.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.